When you use a mercury sphygmomanometer, that's what your doctor does. I don't know if doctors still use that. Quite likely they use that. They put a cuff and then inflate it and block circulation and stop circulation completely, put a stethoscope and listen to the sound as they release the pressure and blood starts to flow back through the arm. When the initial pulses of blood come, if you note the pressure that you have applied or the pressure that is remaining after you have released the cuff a little bit, that indicates the systolic pressure. There will still be pulsatile sound because the diastolic pressure could be lower than the cuff pressure. When the cuff pressure drops below the diastolic pressure, then there is smooth flow of blood, and then these sounds that are known as Korotkov cough sounds don't exist anymore. So you measure the diastolic pressure at that point. But when a doctor does that, or when a technologist does that, you should note that the systolic pressure is measured at a certain instant of time, the diastolic a few seconds later, and in between there would be several heartbeats or cardiac cycles. And you're not measuring the systolic and diastolic pressure of the same cardiac cycle. Not with this method. Okay? So here is an illustration. Some of these, let me see. I could zoom this up a bit, but I can't show you the whole picture. This measurement is 122 millimeters of mercury, which is the systolic pressure, and 66, which is diastolic. The normal is usually about 120 and 80. And for this patient, it was measured continuously using some sort of a catheter-based transducer, but it was recorded only every 2 hours. In some cases, the temperature and pressure transducer could be put inside when the patient is catheterized for some other purpose. You normally don't do the catheterization just to measure pressure or temperature. In this case, the patient had the whole instrumentation set up, so the temperature and pressure were in fact recorded continuously, obtained continuously, but not stored continuously. The pressure data I have were at 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, a sampling interval of 2 hours, as for the temperature. There's systolic pressure and diastolic pressure at every measurement instant. Having said that, you should recognize these two are not at the same instant of time because you don't have both pressures at the same time. At least a part of the cardiac cycle has to be completed. Quite likely, several cardiac cycles will pass in between them if it is a manual measurement using a cuff. This could be measurement using transducers that are put inside the patient, and then these could belong to the same cardiac cycle. So at every point in time, now you have two measurements. Let's assume that the distinction between them is not important because the time scale is a matter of hours, whereas the difference between the systolic and diastolic pressure is of the order of a few milliseconds or seconds. So assume that these two are together, and then at every point in time or in this array, we have two values, so it's a vector. So this can be seen as a vector signal. And if you put temperature also, then it's a three-element vector. The units of each measurement could be different, but every point of time, you have three measurements, temperature, systolic pressure, diastolic pressure. You can put them in an array. So now you have a vector as a function of time. And if you plot this, you get this. So at 8 o'clock or at this point in time, there are some other data points that I haven't shown there. These are actual data points. So this is every hour. So I do have data points for every hour. In the list, in the array, I have shown only for every 2 hours. So here you have the maximum at 9 o'clock when it went to 160, 80, and then came down and is within the normal band for that patient. Your normal could be slightly different from my normal if you're an athlete and or you have some other practices of exercise or yoga, your blood pressure would be different. Your normal pressure would be different from some other person's normal pressure. So 160 could be normal for this person. But it went up here for some reason. I don't know what happened. That's not what we are interested in. All I want to show here is a vector as a function of time. If you want, I can put the temperature also here. Then there are three elements at every point in time. Okay? We just check what our schedule is. Okay, we've been going for about an hour. We will take a break at about 4 o'clock. Is it okay? You're not tired yet, I suppose. Okay, good. So we'll keep going. So let's look at a few signals now. What I gave here as an example, temperature and pressure, they are very basic elementary measurements. But I would like you to appreciate the notion of scalar and vector measurements as individual measurements, as arrays, and as functions of time. So that was the purpose of this simple example. So, the basic electrical signal of the simplest unit of a living organism is what is called the action potential of a single cell. Action potential, the two words indicate two important aspects. One is potential, so it's an electrical signal. And the first word is action, so there is some action associated with the signal. And this signal is the electrical signal that accompanies the mechanical contraction of a single cell. There are contractile cells in our body. So when I'm doing this, there are muscle fibers and cells, or I should say muscle fibers at the level of the unit that we are interested in. The muscle cell units contract to produce this movement. In doing so, or in order to do so, they have to be stimulated under my control. So if I want to do this, my brain has to issue the command and tell these units to contract and do this action. As long as this path, the nervous path, is working, I'm in control of this. So under volitional control, I can do this. If there is a problem, if my spinal cord is damaged, or if some part of my brain is damaged, or if there is some damage to the nerves that connect from my brain to these muscle units, I would lose control. So to do this, there is stimulation that is required, which is an electrical signal that is neural in this case, as I'm doing this, or could be external. We could do some experiments where we apply an electrical, little electrical shock, and then cause the contraction. So it could be neural or external. In doing this contraction, there is a signal that is generated at the cellular level. Every cell generates a little signal that's characteristic of that particular cell. And we need to understand that so that then we can talk about the ECG or the EMG as the collective response of a number of cells. The basic cause of this signal, so we talk about electrical signals, but if you talk to a biochemist, the biochemist will say, no, you're only looking at the bigger phenomenon. If you go down to the detail at the lowest level, it's not electrical in the sense of an electrical current, but it is the movement of ions. So a biochemist will say it's just sodium and potassium ions that are running across. But at a slightly larger level, coming back a little bit, we can view this as a current. So the basic cause of the action potential is the flow of sodium, potassium, chloride, and other ions. Sodium and potassium are positive, the chloride ion is negative. There are a few other ions that do cross boundaries of the cells, but these are the most important ones. So the action potential is the basic component of all bioelectrical signals, not the heart sounds and so on, but electrical signals. It provides information on the nature of the physiological activity at the single cell level of the muscle or the nervous system that you are studying. The recording of an action potential requires the isolation of a single cell. you'll have to take the cell out, maintain it alive in a dish, and then you can stimulate it using instrumentation. You will not be able to study it in a living body generally, but there are some possibilities of putting microelectrodes in and recording signals, not exactly at the single cell level, but at a lower level of collections of cells from a living body. But typically, the experiments done to record action potentials involve the extraction of the tissue from an animal and then maintaining it alive in some sort of a medium, stimulating it using external electrical stimulation. You need microelectrodes with tips of the order of a few micrometers to put the electrode into the cell and to stimulate the cell and record the response. And that is possible. One of my colleagues at the University of Calgary has done a lot of work in this area. But there are a few important points here that we need to note. And by the way, all of these details are in the book. So if you wish, you can make notes. If I go too fast, you may not be able to, if I go fast, you may not be able to write down the details, but all of these are in the book. So you could just listen and then read the book if you wish. If I go too fast, again, please ask me to slow down and explain. So an action potential has a few different parts. The first is resting potential. When nothing is happening and the cell is just living happily, there is a certain situation at rest. And that situation can be explained in this manner. Nerve and muscle cells are encased in what is called a semipermeable membrane. A cell has some fluid in it, and it has a membrane that separates the cell from its background. So the cell is contained in a membrane, and within the membrane it has certain things, and outside there are other cells and other fluids and so on. This membrane is called semipermeable, meaning it'll allow the passage of some elements and ions in one direction and not the other, and will allow some ions to flow easily and block others. So the permeability of the membrane to different ions is different, and that is controlled by the state of the cell. So selected substances are allowed to pass through, in or out, and others are blocked. But the body fluids surrounding the cells are conductive solutions in our body. There is salt, there are various types of salts in fluids, and these are conductive solutions. They contain charged atoms that are known as ions. In the resting state, the membranes of excitable cells permit the entry of sodium positive ion and the chloride ion, but block sodium ions. That's the nature of the gates that control the transmission or passage of ions. And these are what are called voltage-sensitive or voltage-triggered gates. Depending upon the voltage that is applied, either from outside external control or from stimulation within the body, from my brain to the finger muscle, depending upon the stimulus that is applied, the permeability varies. The permeability for potassium is 50 to 100 times that for sodium. Now, various ions try to establish some sort of a balance between the inside and the outside according to charge and concentration. And there is a certain state at the resting state that the cell stays under. And that state is maintained as long as the cell is alive. And that requires effort, and the cell has to be fed and maintained alive. So this is a very simple schematic representation. This is not in the book. This is in my updates notes, if you can download that later. So this is an excitable cell. It's enclosed in this semipermeable membrane. There are fluids outside and inside. They're conductive. There are many different ions These are the important ones. Calcium is also a positive ion. I have drawn here schematically. This big arrow means this particular ion can come easily inside. This means this ion can go not so easily. And this means this particular ion has more resistance and cannot go out easily. And that one can come in at this stage. So this is just the idea of selective permeability. Some ions can move in and out, whereas others cannot, depending upon the state of the cell. Under resting state, there is more potassium inside, less sodium than the outside, as compared to the outside. More sodium and more potassium and less sodium. So the concentration is different between the inside and the outside of the various ions. So there is a gradient. If you were to ask how much potassium is here and here, there is a gradient, more here and less there. And the opposite for sodium. Under resting conditions, there is a difference of minus 90 millivolts. So a cell that is alive maintains a charge of minus 90 millivolts. Now that's quite a lot of charge for a little cell to maintain. Now, if a trigger is applied, if an electrical stimulus is applied, either under volitional control or under experimental conditions, then the transmission characteristics or the permeability characteristics of the membrane will change. The gates that control the passage of the ions will now behave differently. Now, potassium, the permeability to potassium increases. So potassium, we had more inside before than outside. With the channels open, because of the gradient, potassium now will go outside. So from inside the cell, potassium goes outside. Sodium was less on the inside than the outside. So sodium will come inside. So the balance is now changed. Potassium will leave and sodium will come in, and they are both positive ions. The other ions also move in and out. Calcium, chloride ions will move in and out, but these are the most important ones in the sense of quantity and movement. The relative distribution of sodium and potassium will change in response to the stimulus. And when the stimulus is removed, it's a temporary short stimulus that is applied. In response to the stimulus, the cell undergoes a process that is called depolarization. I forgot to mention, in the resting state, the cell is said to be polarized. In response to a stimulus, it is depolarized, and the inside becomes positive up to about 20-30 millivolts. So there is a big change of about 100 to 120 millivolts in response to a trigger. What was negative now becomes positive. Okay? And that is because essentially these fast sodium channels open and sodium rushes inside and potassium goes out. Okay, this I already mentioned, so let me skip this. So, in the resting state, the cell is polarized and there is a minus 60 to minus 100 millivolt resting potential. And depolarization is when a cell is excited, as I showed in that picture, and sodium comes in large quantity. And this constitutes what is called an ionic current. Whenever there is movement of charge, there is a current. And an interesting feature exists here, which is known as the avalanche effect. Like you see when snow starts to roll down mountains and the snow that begins to snow pack that begins to form and move at the top gathers momentum and quantity, and by the time the snow comes down at the lower levels, it could be a huge movement what is called the avalanche and very destructive. Here, something similar happens, not destructive, but when sodium ions move, there is ionic current, and that current reduces the membrane barrier to sodium. So some movement of sodium will facilitate more movement of sodium, and that is known as an avalanche effect. And sodium ions rush inside into the cell. The potassium ions try to leave the cell because of the concentration gradient that existed before, but they don't move as fast as the sodium. The net result is that the inside becomes positive. That is what I mentioned earlier. So this is a different state now. It is in an excited state, in a depolarized state. The effect of the stimulus is temporary. Of course, if you keep applying an electric current, you could fry or burn the cell and kill it. But suppose you apply just a short pulse, which is what happens when I contract my muscle. There are short pulses given, and each pulse will cause an action potential and contraction for a certain period. This represents the beginning of the action potential. The stimulus is finished and gone. The cell has reached the depolarized state and is positive inside now with reference to the outside. So this is the depolarized state. Now, it cannot stay, the cell cannot stay in this condition forever. After the stimulus is removed, the membrane returns to its original position. The channels that facilitated the movement of the ions now go back to the original state or the resting state. So that process is known as repolarization. The cell was polarized, became depolarized, and through a retrieval or recovery process goes back to the original state through repolarization. And this also happens in a similar manner of movement of ions, which is similar to what we saw earlier, but in the opposite direction. The principal ions involved are the potassium ions. There are these voltage-dependent channels, as I mentioned earlier, and the predominant membrane permeability is for potassium. The potassium concentration is much higher inside, and the net efflux of potassium from the cell, it becomes negative, and that goes back to the resting potential. So the reverse of what happened in response to the stimulus will now take place. The change in the concentration will be reversed. Now, this process is known as repolarization. Depending upon the nature of the cell and the part of the body where the cell lives, the duration of the action potential and the repolarization process would vary. Nerve and muscle cells repolarize rapidly and have action potential durations of about 1 millisecond. Heart muscle cells repolarize slowly, and the action potential is of the order of 150 to 300 milliseconds. So it varies from cell to cell. Nerve cells are involved in transmission of information or stimulus, and they have to pass the information rapidly. Heart muscles have to contract and hold the contraction level to facilitate pumping of blood and maintain a certain pressure for certain durations of time, which are of the order of several tens of milliseconds, and hence the action potential duration is longer. There are a few important points about the action potential. The action potential is always the same for a given cell, regardless of the method of excitation or the intensity of the stimulus that is applied. If you apply the minimum level of excitation required, let's assume it is 100 volts. If you apply that, you will get a response. If you apply 110 volts, you will not get more, you will get the same thing. If you apply 150 volts, you still get the same response. The action potential is always the same. It does not depend upon the level of the input except above a threshold. If you apply 20 volts, you will get nothing. If you apply 80 volts, you get nothing, assuming the minimum required is 100. I'm just using some number for illustration. Of course, if you apply 1,000 volts, you will kill the cell and burn it. It'll die. It won't give you this response. So this is known as all or none or all or nothing. It's not linear. The cell does what it is intended to or designed to do, nothing more, nothing less. After an action potential, there is a certain resting period, recovery period, that is known as the refractory period. In this period, the cell recovers and goes back to its original state and will not respond to another stimulus. This period is known as the absolute refractory period. If you put another stimulus of 100 volts, nothing happens. The cell will simply keep quiet. Of course, if you apply 1,000 volts again, you will kill it. But there is another period following the absolute refractory period that is called the relative refractory period, where another action potential could be triggered by a slightly stronger stimulus. So we said earlier there is the all or none phenomenon. It applies here. You will get the full response, but to elicit a response from a cell in its resting period, in what is called the relative resting period, you will need to apply a stronger stimulus. So that's an exception to what I said earlier. So here is an example of an action potential recorded from a myocyte, which is a cell from the cardiac system of a rabbit. This is from the ventricle of a rabbit, the lower chamber in the heart, where the stimulus was applied at zero, and there is an increase. The action potential resting position is here. It's about minus 80 millivolts. This is from Dr. Clark in the Department of Physiology and Biophysics at the University of Calgary. And I have seen his experimental setup. He has these cells isolated and maintained alive. And he has these little microelectrodes. I'll show you a picture in a moment. He applies the stimulus. And in response to the stimulus, the cell potential goes from minus 80 to plus 40 millivolts. So this is the excitation. So from being polarized, it becomes depolarized. And then it maintains this potential for a certain period of time, which is of the order of 300 milliseconds, and then comes down to the resting state. The total duration is about 350, 400 milliseconds for the ventricles, the lower chamber of the heart, which is similar to what we have too. From a human being also, the myocyte of the ventricle will have a duration of about 300, 350 milliseconds. In this case, because the cell is maintained in an artificial environment outside the body of the rabbit, the characteristics could be slightly different from what it does within the body under natural conditions. But the general idea is the same. This is the action potential from a rabbit's atrial myocyte, that is from the upper chamber of the heart, where the contraction is different. The upstroke is fast, the decay is also fast, and it does not maintain contraction for a long time. The contraction characteristics of the atria are different from those of the ventricles. I'll explain those later. The return is also slow. So here are two pictures of I'm pretty sure it is a ventricular myocyte. Let me see here. Let me read this part first. This is a single ventricular myocyte of a rabbit. Above is relaxed, lower is contracted state. The length of the myocyte, this length is about 25 micrometers. There is a glass pipette here, the microelectrode that's been introduced, and that is about 2 micrometers wide. This is about 2 micrometers in thickness. The stimulus was 3 milliseconds and 1 nanoampere in amplitude. So what we have here is the myocyte. Here it is relaxed and in its resting state. The length is that much. When the stimulus is applied through this glass pipette, the cell was triggered into the depolarized state. And in going to the depolarized state, there is an action, which is contraction. The length is changed. So this length now is a little shorter than what you have up there. They are at the same scale, so you can see the contraction. And that's the response of the cell. Skeletal cells and cells of the cardiac system contract in response to a stimulus. Whereas cells in the nervous system along a nerve do not contract. They have an action potential. They just pass the stimulus and pass the current. So there is the conduction system, which is like an electrical wire, but it's not, the conduction mechanism is different. I'll mention that later on. But in the case of contractile muscular cells, there is a change in the dimension of the cell in response to excitation along with the action potential. So here, along with the action potential just that I showed you just now, there is also contraction, which is what happens when we also activate our peripheral muscles. So a few points about the propagation of action potentials. An action potential propagates along a muscle fiber or an unmyelinated nerve fiber in this manner. Once initiated by a stimulus, the action potential propagates along the whole length of the fiber without any loss in its voltage. There is no decrease in amplitude, and that's not electrical conduction like in a copper wire, but it is progressive depolarization of the cells along the membrane. So when one cell is stimulated, it has an action potential. It affects the neighboring, it affects its neighborhood. The related potential is then transmitted to the next unit. That is triggered and contracts or transmits, creates the change in its environment, and that in turn triggers the next and so on. It happens fairly rapidly, but it's transmission by progressive depolarization. Current flows from a depolarized region through the intracellular fluid. In between the cells, there is fluid that is conductive, and that transmits the trigger from one cell to another, and that depolarizes them. So in this manner, there is transmission of the action potential. So there is also current flowing through the extracellular fluids in the neighborhood of each cell. Through the depolarized membrane, the membrane that encloses the cell, and back into the intracellular space, that completes a local circuit. There is no transmission of charge or ions from my brain to the end of my finger, but the change is very local, but that movement of the charge of the ions constitutes a current that is transmitted. So in that way, there is transmission along or within muscle units as well as through nerves. Now there is energy required to do this, and that energy is supplied by the fiber or the cell, and that has to be maintained alive and active. There is a difference in another situation known as myelinated nerve fibers. The nerve fiber is covered by an insulating sheath of what is called myelin. So each part is isolated electrically from its environment. However, this is broken, the myelin sheath is broken, and the nerve is exposed to its background at specific intervals of every few millimeters. And these are known as nodes of Ranvier. And sites of excitation and changes of membrane permeability exist only at the nodes, and the current flows by jumping from one node to another. And that is known as saltatory conduction. So in a difference as compared to what I said earlier, for unmyelinated nerve and muscle cells, there is this situation where in myelinated nerves, there is insulation and there are current units that jump from one node to the next, and that is a different type of conduction known as saltatory, which is jumping conduction. Any questions on what we have seen so far? We will do a little bit more and then take a break. There is a signal known as the electroneurogram, EMG, not the EMG, M is for myo. The EMG is an electrical signal observed as a stimulus and the associated nerve action potential propagate over the length of a nerve. If you want to study the conduction properties of a nerve to see if the nerve is functioning properly, then you would want to record the ENG associated with that nerve. It may be used to measure the velocity of propagation or conduction velocity of a stimulus or action potential along the nerve. An ENG may be recorded using concentric needle electrodes, so you take a needle and put it inside, or silver chloride electrodes at the surface of the body, typically along the median nerve, and you put electrodes here, and you apply a stimulus and study how the stimulus goes through the system. Conduction velocity in a peripheral nerve, such as along the arm, is measured by stimulating a motor nerve and measuring the related activity at two points along the nerve, separated by some distance. You measure the distance in centimeters, and then you measure the time difference between the pulses related to the transmission of a signal that you apply. The stimulus that is applied is of the order of 100 volts, and the pulse is about 100 to 300 microseconds in duration to cause contraction. So you apply, typically, you put the stimulus, you apply the stimulus, and apply an adequate stimulus so as to cause contraction of a certain muscle, such as a finger. You stimulate the median nerve until the subject performs a certain contraction that can be observed, which means something is being propagated along the nerve. Now, this is not volitional contraction, because with volitional contraction, you may not be able to record the signal from the nerve from the surface. In order to record something from the surface, you apply a certain stimulus to cause contraction, and you measure the associated signal along the nerve by attaching electrodes. The ENG amplitude is of the order of 10 microvolts, so you need significant amplification and noise control. The amplifier gain is typically about 2,000. The bandwidth of recording is 10 to 10,000 hertz. So these are fairly fast signals. And here is an example from the Children's Hospital in Calgary, where you have these patterns recorded at the wrist here, below the elbow here, and above the elbow here. So the signal is going the opposite way. So this is not the signal from the brain that is transmitted causing volitional control, but an external stimulus is applied to cause contraction, and the associated signal is measured along the nerve at the wrist, below the elbow, above the elbow. So this is the wrist, below the elbow, above the elbow, and you know you can measure these distances, and the stimulus was applied here at the finger, and this is the starting point at the wrist, this is the starting point below the elbow, this is above the elbow. You measure the time difference, and you know the distance, so you calculate the velocity of conduction. The waveform is not very important. If you want, you can analyze the waveform. But in studies on nerve conduction velocity, all you want to know is where does it start, or what is the delay, or the term used is latency. What is the latency between these signals at the wrist, below the elbow, above the elbow, and divide the distance by the time, and you get the velocity. And in this case, the wrist, and here, by the way, each box is 2 microvolts, and each box this way, horizontally, is 3 milliseconds. So the time difference is of the order of 3, 4, 5 milliseconds. The below elbow to wrist latency is 3.23 milliseconds, and the velocity in this case is 64.9 meters per second. So this is the nerve conduction velocity, several meters per second. Whereas in a muscle fiber or within a muscle, the conduction is much, much slower, by a factor of 10 or maybe 100. Okay? So here are some examples. 45 to 70 meters per second in nerve fibers, 0.2 to 0.4 in the heart muscle, and that's a factor of 100, and 0.03 to 0.05 meters per second in time delay fibers in the atrioventricular node between the atria and ventricles. These are specifically designed to give a time gap between contraction of the atria and contraction of the ventricles. So this is another factor of 100. But this is not, that's by design. It's intended to introduce delay rather than conduct. Of course, conduction also happens. Okay. It's 10 minutes to 4. Let's take a break here. The next is EMG. So rather than starting the EMG now, we'll take a break for 15 minutes. So we'll start at 5 minutes after 4.